We would like to invite everyone back to this to their, take their seat. We're ready to continue with this afternoon's program. Once again, those who are joining us online and the various television networks, just a reminder of our free gift today, Amazing Facts Magazine, America in Prophecy. Now, this is free. All you have to do is just text the word magazine to the number 40544. You'll be able to receive a digital download of the magazine. For those of you, once again, outside of North America, please visit the website afsummit.org, and you'll be able to download a copy of the magazine. Have you been blessed thus far? Well, I tell you, this has been such a blessing, such a treat to be able to dig into the Word of God. We've got a wonderful presentation that is about to begin. Now, we decided to, at this time, include the rose amongst the thorns. We've got Reese that's going to be presenting, Reese Rafferty. We heard from James last night. And Reese, James's wife, is going to be presenting the one with the most interesting title of all the presentations, the whole thing, a comprehensive, holistic, innovative, evidence-based, cutting-edge health message. I am looking forward to that. Following her presentation, we will then have our Q&A panel. So thank you, Reese, and God bless.
Good afternoon. I was raised in a town with no billboards advertising alcohol or tobacco cigarettes. Every Friday evening, bells rung, and every Saturday at sundown, the bells rung as well. Our mail was never delivered on Sabbath. It was always delivered on Sunday instead. If we were hungry and my mom hadn't cooked, she sometimes would leave us some money, and we would ride our bikes to the market or even to the hospital to get a veggie burger. And that was before there were impossible beyonds. Yeah, this was a great place to live. When I had to go to school, I would either ride my bike or I'd walk along a ditch a little over a mile. Can you imagine doing that from the age of six? Probably most parents, I would never let my kid just, you know, walk over a mile to school, but we did. And I remember the dairy farm where the elementary school now is. So not too long ago, I talked with an incarcerated man in a state penitentiary, and he was telling me how he grew up in the slums of New Orleans. And there he survived, he said, on pigtail. He said, I have no idea what it means to eat healthfully. I was blessed to live in a blue zone. Loma Linda was discovered by Dan Buettner, and he was looking for something in America. Where could there be a population, a group, that he could call a blue zone? And he found Loma Linda, a spiritual-based community whose community members lived approximately 11 years longer than the average American, and it had its fair share of centenarians. Now, why would Loma Linda be so blessed? There's a map of the blue zones that Dan Buettner, are most of you familiar with the blue zones? That Dan Buettner found, and there are some real live centenarians living in Loma Linda. These are men who are 100 years old or more and have clearly found their own fountain of youth. So what is it? What was it? What was the information? What did these guys have that maybe other communities didn't have that gave them this cutting-edge start, this ability to live so long and to live healthfully? Well, clearly they had something that others don't. What is that? Why would Loma Linda be such a healthy place? I believe that Seventh-day Adventist Church was organized not just to add one more church to the mix, right? But that God actually gave a very special, cutting-edge, holistic, present-day message that was to be given to the world in the form of three angels, we're told. And health promotion, health education, our health message was to be tagged on to that. So it wasn't until my first year of college that I learned that we had a health message. And I read a book there entitled Healthy, Happy, Holy. Such a great title, Healthy, Happy, Holy. And I was like, oh, that's why we have veggie burgers in our Loma Linda market and in our hospitals. My second year of college, I came back to California. I'd gone my first year of college abroad, second year came back, and while I was here, I developed this excruciating pain in my abdomen. Went to the local doctor at the hospital there, and they thought they were going to have to do surgery. Told me to go back to my dorm room. I was there in bed, and a new friend came in with this real tall glass of a black slurry. Never seen that before. I raised my eyes from bed, and she said, "Just drink it." I did, and it wasn't too much longer after that that I became a total charcoal believer. I was healed. I also read Loma Linda messages that in that year. I saw a book, Loma Linda. Oh, I wonder what she had to say to Loma Linda. Picked it up and read it. And after that, I was hooked. I tried to find anything I could in our church's writings on the topic of health. And these were things that I read. There is sickness everywhere, and much of it might be prevented by attention to the laws of health. I was taking nursing at the time, and as they were taking us up on the floors, I learned that 70% of what we would see there would be lifestyle related. I also read that the stomach must have careful attention. It must not be kept in continual operation. After the regular meal is eaten, the stomach should be allowed to rest for 5 hours. Not a particle of food should be introduced into the stomach till the next meal. In this interval, the stomach will perform its work and will then be in a condition to receive more food. Then I learned about the migrating motor complex. Are you familiar with the migrating motor complex? It is your gut's housekeeper. That is how it has been endearingly labeled, nicknamed. It is actually just kind of a combination of electrical waves and muscular contractions and squirts of digestive juices that all kind of collaborate and come together when we're not eating, when we're in a fasting state. And these electrical actions and squirts of digestive juices and muscular contractions perform really important roles. They clean out the debris from the previous meal. They control bacterial overgrowth, keeping it swept. They promote optimal digestion by prepping the GI tract for its next job. So the housekeeper. Like any housekeeper, she would be very foolish to start cleaning the house while the party was still going on. So she waits. She waits till the party's over, and then she comes in while we're in that fasting state to do her sweeping, to do her cleaning, cleaning out the debris, making sure that the bacteria in our digestive tract remain in the lower part of our digestive tract rather than kind of migrating up. It's pretty fascinating. So the advice of 5 hours is really significant because it takes time for us to be able to digest our food, and then she sets in. She needs time to do her thing while we're in that fasting state. And if the party starts all over again, and it doesn't matter whether it's a Cheeto or a carrot, the housekeeper's gonna go, "I'm out of here. I'll wait till the party's really over." So she leaves and does not perform her job unless we are truly fasting. So 5 hours. Now, if you only had a half a grapefruit for breakfast, obviously that wouldn't take as long to digest, so it wouldn't take as much time. But 5 hours is still a really good rule of thumb. Deficiencies in the migrating motor complex have been associated with constipation, irritable bowel syndrome, SIBO, inflammatory bowel disease, gastroparesis, and excess gas. These are very common conditions in our society today. People with these conditions who experience bloating, gas, and maldigestion have been observed to have higher rates of depressed or non-functional MMC. We have shooed the housekeeper away so much, she's like, "These guys don't need me. I'm going to go find work somewhere else." Your housekeeper is extremely valuable, and like most housekeepers, underappreciated in terms of the value that they provide to the quality of our life. So Mom said no snacks, and she said it for a reason. She might not have known all the reasons, but hopefully now you have a little bit more reason. I also read that it's the custom and order of society to take a slight breakfast, but this is not the best way to treat the stomach. At breakfast time, the stomach is in a better condition to take care of more food than at the second or third meal of the day. And you know what I learned? I learned that we are the most insulin sensitive, guess when? In the morning. That's when we are the most insulin sensitive. What does that mean? That means that the body is not going to have to require as much insulin to do its job of taking care of all that fuel that you just ate. It also means that your muscle and your fat and your liver cells are all going to be having better communication with insulin at that time of the day. You're going to be better able to process a lot of food. Now, to prove this, people have done quite a bit of research because, you know, we always hear the wives' tale, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. And yet when you look around now, that's the one meal that people skip the most. And often for various reasons. Maybe they're not hungry. Maybe they're trying to engage in the intermittent fasting concept. So was mom right or not? This was a really interesting study. It was only done with 9 healthy Japanese men aged 19 to 24, but this is really significant. Right? They're healthy young men, age 19 to 24, and they participated in this study in which for the first part of the trial, they ate 3 meals a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner. All right? Then they had a week break in between, and then for the next part of the trial, they skipped breakfast. But the other 2 meals, lunch and dinner, were exactly the same as they had eaten during that first part of the trial. And this is what the researchers observed. So here at the dark line is you can see their blood sugar levels after breakfast, after lunch, and after dinner. Just this normal pattern. Our blood sugar naturally rises after meals. Now, when they fasted for breakfast, and that's this line right here, you see a flat line. No elevation in their blood sugar. That would be assumed, right? That's normal. But look what happened after the lunch. A dramatic increase in their blood sugar levels, almost double than what they had experienced when they ate breakfast. Okay, are you tracking with me so far? So a much more dramatic blood sugar surge after lunch when they had fasted for breakfast. And then they finally kind of evened out for dinner. This right here is showing their insulin response. So true to pattern, we secrete insulin when we eat. Good, needed. So for breakfast, they secreted insulin. For lunch, they secreted insulin. And for dinner. Now, when they fasted and they didn't eat the breakfast, flat line. Didn't need the insulin, didn't secrete it. But look what happened after their lunch. The researchers noted a much higher insulin secretion, and in some of the men, it was 30 minutes delayed. So their body wasn't responding as well. And here you can see they measured free fatty acids. These were the 3 things that they measured. I neglected to share that with you. They were measuring their fasting blood sugar. They were wearing a glucometer that was 24-hour, reading what their blood sugar was 24 hours. Then they were measuring their insulin secretion by measuring a substance called C-peptide. And they were also measuring their free fatty acid levels. So how would skipping breakfast affect these? All right, we already saw what happened to their blood sugar. This is what happened to their insulin. And now with their free fatty acids, look at what happened with those who ate, when they ate the breakfast, okay? Kind of this low free fatty acid profile. Now, when they skipped breakfast, it's much higher free fatty acid levels in their blood, even after their lunch period. Are you kind of wondering why this would be? What's going on? They weren't eating. Why would blood sugars be elevated more after lunch? Why would insulin levels be higher? And why would their free fatty acids in their blood be so elevated even when they weren't eating? That's what took place. And as a result, the researchers assumed that the reason for this... Did I read that? Let's read through this. Skipping breakfast resulted in a significantly higher glycemic response after lunch as compared with the glycemic response after an identical lunch when breakfast was consumed. Insulin, or C-peptide peak, was delayed 30 minutes after lunch on the breakfast skipping day, and their free fatty acid level in the morning and after lunch was significantly higher when breakfast was skipped. And the researchers concluded that the reason for this was because the free fatty acids were promoting insulin resistance in their liver, causing their liver to also secrete more blood sugar, causing higher blood sugar levels, and basically resulting in a state of insulin resistance. Now, these young men weren't pre-diabetic. they didn't have diabetes. But here we're seeing a completely shifted way of processing food, resulting in this dysmetabolism, a state that would look like pre-diabetes. So we had elevated blood sugar, elevated and delayed insulin, elevated free fatty acids, contributing factor to liver insulin resistance, impaired insulin response, and increased liver glucose production in a healthy young man. Wow. Anybody willing to start eating your breakfast, just knowing what would be going on in your body when you didn't eat it? We found that lower weekly breakfast consumption was associated, this was a different study, with a higher risk of insulin resistance in Koreans. So again, increasing this metabolic, these mechanisms that are changing our metabolism and shifting us in the direction of at least pre-diabetes and impaired glucose regulation. This was another study that was done. It was a 12-week long study with overweight, obese women with metabolic syndrome. And what they did was they divided these ladies in half. One group ate a heavy breakfast, as you can see there, and one group ate a heavy dinner. They ate the exact same amount of food, the exact same calories, the exact same, you know, macronutrients and so forth. However, when you eat most of those calories and that food at breakfast time, this is what the women experienced. So breakfast eaters experienced greater weight loss, skinnier waist, reduction in fasting blood sugar, reduction in insulin, reduction in their measurements of insulin resistance. Their triglyceride levels decreased 33.6%, but increased in the dinner eating women 14.6%. Overall, blood sugar, insulin, and ghrelin, which is your I'm hungry hormone, and hunger scores were significantly lower in the breakfast eaters. Satiety scores were significantly higher as well. That means that we're more satisfied with eating more of their food at breakfast time. This was a different study. Actually, this is 14 cohort studies. And the results of this was that compared with people having breakfast less than three times a week, those with a frequency of eating breakfast greater than three times a week have a reduced risk of type 2 diabetes, obesity, metabolic syndrome, elevated cholesterol, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, and strokes. Who would have thought that eating breakfast was such a big deal and potentially a player in our society's leading killers and disease processes? Skipping breakfast is associated with overweight and obesity. So we often skip breakfast to skip the calories, try to lose weight. We think it's helping us, but as we can see here, it's really not. Then I read that the practice of eating but two meals a day is generally found a benefit to health. Yet under some circumstances, persons may require a third meal. This should, however, if taken at all, be very light and a food most easily digested. Anybody heard of time-restricted feeding or time-restricted eating? Isn't it interesting how the world is just kind of researching these topics for us? 16:8 or 14:10, these are windows of time in which we are fasting or in which we are allowing ourselves to be partaking of food. All right. So the 16:8, for example, would be I'm fasting for 16 hours of my 24-hour day and no food is entering my mouth, not even juice, alcohol, caffeine that's sweetened or has cream in it. And then for 8 hours, that's my window of time in which I partake of my meals. So what do you think of this time-restricted feeding? Sounds crazy, doesn't it? Who are you to tell me when I can eat and when I can't eat? But, you know, most of us are used to eating whenever we feel like it and whenever we think about it, right? Especially now that we're working from home. Oh, it sounds like, that sounds kind of good. I think I'm going to go get, or we hear, you know, our name being called from the pantry or the freezer, and so we find ourselves pitter-pattering over there, and we're eating. Was it planned eating? No. It was impulsive, erratic eating, and we're good at it. We eat just before we go to bed. We eat in the middle of the night. We think about food or eat anytime we want to. Turns out that 16:8, naturally, we do in the exact opposite. We're more apt to eat over 16 hours in a 16-hour window and maybe not eat during that 8-hour time in which we're sleeping. Can we think about reversing it? Because there's some really good reasons why. 80% of adults in America consume food within that 16-hour window. 90% of adults eat in a window that's over 12 hours in America. But this time-restricted eating, could we think about, two meals maybe is a good idea for us, maybe three if you need some, but can we limit that time of day in which we're thinking or eating food? So time-restricted eating has been found to reduce body weight, improve glucose tolerance, we're talking about our blood sugar and our ability to process the food we eat, it protects us from fatty liver, increases metabolic flexibility, meaning we can transition from different fuel sources, reduces atherogenic lipids, those are the cholesterols that we get measured all the time to see if what our risk is for cardiovascular disease, blood pressure, it improves gut function, and cardiometabolic health in preclinical studies. So Dr. Kaliyeva is a Seventh-day Adventist physician and researcher. She's amazing. She works for the Physicians Committee of Responsible Medicine, and she does a lot of research with some of these kinds of concepts. And this was the results of a study that she and others conducted that was entitled Eating Two Larger Meals a Day, Breakfast and Lunch is More Effective Than Six Smaller Meals in a Reduced Energy Regimen for Patients with Type 2 Diabetes. So we hear a lot about, six meals a day eating is good. It's going to be good for building muscle. It's good for losing weight. It's just good, good, good. And yet, is it? Has anyone ever bothered to, look at the evidence and do the research? So she did. And what they found was that eating only breakfast and lunch reduced body weight, liver fat content, fasting blood sugar, C-peptide, which is a measurement of your insulin levels, glucagon, which is a hormone that actually contributes to blood sugar. Many times people will say, man, I have high blood sugar and I didn't even eat anything. Well, that's the hormone glucagon telling your liver to secrete blood sugar. So they had lower levels of this and increased insulin sensitivity more than the same caloric restriction split into six meals. So again, these were people eating the exact same food, exact same amount of calories. They were on a weight loss goal, so where they were restricting their calories, but when they ate all those calories in two meals versus six, these were the beneficial outcomes. So they've even done these kind of studies with mice. And as you can see here on the left-hand side, both of these mice were fed a high-fat diet, but the mice on the left could eat their food anytime they wanted to over a 24-hour period, whereas the mice on the left were restricted. They were on that 16-8. They could only eat those same calories in an 8-hour window of time. And as a result, you can see the results, right? The mouse eating over a 24 period had four times more body fat, even though they ate the same number of calories. Our simplistic equation of calories in subtract calories we expend equals what we weigh is very deficient and very lacking. Obviously, time of day when we're eating has a lot to do with this as well. So this is just another slide showing the benefits of time-restricted eating and how it affects whether we store or use up our lipids, our fats. And because of that, it can affect our weight, our fat mass, our blood sugar, our insulin resistance, how well our pancreas is functioning, our liver fat, levels of inflammation, oxidative stress, blood pressure, and even our sleep. So if you are struggling with any of those, you might want to try this 16-8 or 14-10 window. It's not always easy. I always encourage people to kind of, gradually adjust and see how that can work for you. I also read that a third meal should be eaten several hours before going to bed. The stomach, when we lie down to rest, should have its work all done. That's a hard one, isn't it? Then I learned that not only are we the most insulin sensitive in the morning, but we are the most insulin resistant in the evening. And there would be reasons for that. So here we see that the brain gland produces melatonin in response to cues of light or darkness. So when we have bright light earlier in the day and when we start having dimmer light and darkness at nighttime, that helps our gland and our brain release this melatonin hormone that is so incredibly important. It really is a time setter. It sets the clock in our brain, letting us know what time of day it is. But it does a lot more than that. It is a potent antioxidant. It is a brain detoxer. It clears the proteins that might have accumulated in our brain and that we have found are associated with things like Alzheimer's disease. So something we definitely want going on. And when what we've learned, though, is melatonin starts, in someone who has a good circadian clock, melatonin starts rising a couple hours before we actually go to sleep. And melatonin and insulin have a very interesting relationship. Melatonin actually tucks the pancreas into bed. Just as it causes you to fall asleep, it also puts the pancreas to sleep as well. So we're not secreting as much insulin as melatonin is rising. Now, insulin is the hormone that we desperately need to take the food that we just ate, right, and to put that blood sugar that we get from it into the cells. And without insulin working effectively, we have that pre-diabetes diabetic state in which our blood sugars are becoming elevated and they're not being shuffled into the cells as effectively. So here we see melatonin rising before actually falling asleep. And when melatonin's talking, insulin is quiet. Kind of like a good marriage, right? Not interrupting each other. So melatonin's talking, insulin is quiet, and that's how they work. When insulin's loud, then melatonin is quiet. They listen to each other and they respect each other's, the job that they have to do. So elevated melatonin concentrations with food intake in humans decreases glucose tolerance. So basically saying, we have higher melatonin levels, and now we're eating, guess what? We're going to have impaired glucose tolerance. High melatonin, however, during fasting actually facilitates beta cell recovery. These are statements from PubMed. I'm just pulling these things out of my computer like, wow, this is so fascinating. What that last one is saying is that if melatonin is rising, but you're in a fasting state, you've allowed a few hours to digest your food before going to bed, that actually can promote the recovery of the very cells in our pancreas that become debilitated and damaged in a pre-diabetic diabetic state. Then I read that regularity in eating is of vital importance. Irregularities in eating destroy the healthful tone of the digestive organs to the detriment of health and cheerfulness. Then I learned about chrononutrition. Have you guys heard that phrase before? Chrono as in time, chronology, all right? So chrononutrition is really talking about the timing of eating. And what we're learning is that the timing of eating is just as, if not more significant than what we're eating, right? So timing here now being really, really key. So it has profound effects, as we're going to see. And it really addresses the coordination of our eating times with our circadian rhythms. Maybe my body actually has a time in which it's better able to process food when it's a good time, and the development of regularity really establishing that that time. This is Sachin Panda, who is a researcher in this topic, and this is what he says. Circadian rhythms are the master program that instruct at what time of day or night every brain chemical, every hormone, every enzyme rises and or falls. These daily rhythms enable our brain and body to achieve their optimum performance at every hour of the day or night and allow our body to carry out its daily repair and rejuvenation. Every part of our physiology has clocks. God is that master. I can't remember now how Pastor Wilson, how he shared it, but the timekeeping God that we serve, where time is actually something that's so essential to all the universe, is implanted in our very physiology, in every hormone and every enzyme and every cell. Keeping time. Are we willing to keep time with it? How does our body keep time? I remember growing up that there was this old clock on the top of the fireplace mantle, And my dad would come, and I would see him check his watch and look at the clock and see where they were off, and he would grab this metal key, and he would turn the old clock, right? Anybody ever have a clock like that? Because it would start ticking slower, and when he would wind it, then it would start keeping time again and start ticking just the way it was supposed to. So he was kind of entraining the clock, okay, setting the clock. Well, that's what light does to the master gland, the master clock in our brain. Light does that for us. So that light is the cue that winds the clock in our brain. But we don't have just clocks in our brain, as we just learned. We have clocks everywhere, and those clocks are called peripheral clocks. So we have that central clock, and then we have peripheral clocks in your lungs, in your heart, in your muscle, in your liver, in your pancreas, in your gut. And when these clocks become desynchronized, when they become decoupled from the master clock and from each other, we start seeing disease. Misalignment between master clock and peripheral clocks results in profound impairments in physiologic function and health. So when we eat, so just as light winds this clock in the brain and sets that time, when we eat sets these clocks. All right? That's the input. Light doesn't affect these clocks, but they are exquisitely sensitive to when I eat, to food coming down the hatch. It sets the tempo. So here we see these different clocks that might be, you know, these are just some samples. The muscle clock affecting muscle insulin sensitivity, the pancreatic clock affecting, you know, how we secrete insulin and glucagon, both of those hormones coming from the pancreas. White fat tissue, adipose tissue has a clock, and it affects how we are producing more fat or what we're doing with it. It's just amazing, all these clocks and how they influence the organ and the tissues in which they reside. Their function is very dependent upon how these clocks are ticking. So the rhythm in the gut has been found to be the greatest entrainer, right? We said food, right? The timing of when we're eating is really setting these peripheral clocks, and it does that through the gut. So the rhythm of the gut oversees glucose and lipid levels, hormone secretion, immune response. It affects our metabolism. It affects our hormone levels. It affects our weight. It affects our disease risk. It affects our mood. These things that we've thought of as so insignificant and little and not really worthy of our observation, and yet we're realizing they have a profound impact upon our health. A key element involved in maintaining synced circadian rhythms is the gut microbiome. And if you know anything about me, you know that this is my favorite topic, is our gut microbiome. That is simply referring, or it's also referred to as the gut microbiota, but I like to refer to it as the community, because that's what it is. It is just a community of various different strains and species of bacteria, virus, fungi, and the like, and they all collectively co-inhabit us, and they have, a profound impact upon our health. I see this community and the fact that we are composed so much of microbes as the leftovers from Eden, that when God formed Adam and Eve out of the dust of the ground, what is dust? What is soil composed of? A lot of microbes in healthy soil. Yes, there are minerals for sure, and we have minerals established in our body as well, but this microbial structure of the soil being still alive, I think it's another thing that's been passed down from Eve. That, you know, we talked about that mitochondrial inheritance that we got from Eve that Doug Batchelor shared, but we also have this microbial inheritance from the garden. So here's this community, and this community keeps time. Welcome to the gut, population 100 trillion. There is so many of them, and again, collectively, they create this environment, and they have this influence upon our health, as we're going to see a picture of it. They do it in multiple ways, but definitely as a conductor. I loved watching the conductor today when he was conducting the symphony and the choir and how he was bringing out and silencing and calling forth. This is what the gut can do. So the gut sets the tempo for these clocks in our body. In the intestines, circadian rhythms regulate digestion, including gastric acid production, gut motility, and nutrient absorption. Circadian rhythms also affect intestinal stem cell regeneration and mucosal immunity. Intestinal stem cell regeneration is very important. You know that we kind of create new intestines. I can't remember, I think the colon is just a few days. You know, can you imagine? Those cells, they die quickly and they need to be regenerated. And so this is they form a part of that regeneration. They also form a part of mucosal immunity. Moreover, the microbiota composition and functions depend on the time of the day. This is fascinating to me. I just want to share this with you. So there's my conductor analogy. So different bacteria in your gut. So many different kinds, right? There's just so much diversity, and diversity has really become a hallmark of what we think of as a healthy gut. I always like to think of the ecosystem of the Amazon forest. What makes that such a healthy environment was when everything, all the different strains, species, fauna, you name it, was all collectively, you know, living harmoniously together. And it's the same in our gut. And what they found is that certain strains of the bacteria will populate more at certain times of the day, and then they'll diminish at other times of the day. And they might perform this kind of, you know, action, maybe food processing part of the day, and then another part of the day they're engaged in detox. And it's all this beautiful song and orchestrated, you know, dance that's going on inside of us continually. And guess what messes it up? We do. Oh, that looks good. Pop it in my mouth. Oh, I feel hungry again. You know, all of our eating, right, is just kind of in training this rhythm, and yet because we're not eating regularly, because we're eating whenever we want to, erratically, impulsively, it's altering the music. The conductor's like, I can't get these guys to play harmoniously. This one's keeping a different time than this one, and some of them, you know, they're filing their nails when they should be playing their oboe. That was an instrument that I loved hearing today. That sort of thing is going on in our gut, and it's just fascinating when you see, again, this kind of beautiful synchrony that's supposed to be taking place inside of our guts, and then that tempo, the tempo that they're engaged in, is in training than other aspects, other clocks in our body that are everywhere. And they do that in several ways. We'll talk about that a little later. Disruption of the circadian system can alter the microbiome communities, which affects metabolism, weight, immune function, inflammation, risk of cancer, autoimmune diseases, and metabolic disorders like type 2 diabetes. Does that sound familiar to any of you? Yeah, we're not just talking about some random disease off somewhere. So it's a two-way street. The gut microbiome influences circadian gene expression, and circadian genes influence the gut microbiome. So, and again, all the conditions that can be affected by this desynchronization. So this was another interesting study. Now, this one's not necessarily talking about time. It's just reinforcing the fact that this gut microbiome, this community of microbes, sets the clocks and how the clocks manifest in terms of what we weigh. So in this top line, we see that these mice were raised sterile. So they're called germ-free mice. They were born into a sterile environment. So they never had their guts populated with bacteria. And their moms must have had all their gut bacteria die as well. So anyway, they're sterile. And because they don't have a gut microbiota, they can eat whatever they want to, but they have this circadian disruption, all right? So eating without a gut microbiota, their clocks are off, and yet they don't gain weight, okay? Because the microbes aren't there. So then we have regular mice that have gut microbes, and they eat a low-fat diet. They're conventionally raised. They have normal microbial signals, and so they have a normal clock. The rhythm is going well. The conductor is able to keep everyone in sync. However, then they get on a high-fat diet, and this changes. The high-fat diet, we found, causes an unhealthy community, all right? A desynchronized community. Some are filing their nails, some aren't playing when they're supposed to, they're ignoring the conductor, whatever. And as a result, there's circadian disruption, and guess what happens? They gain weight, right? And they saw that association. So what disrupts the rhythm? When we eat. And here we just see, again, just some connections between the circadian rhythm disruption and all the very significant ways that it impairs our health, our liver health, our increase of cancer, our heart health, our memory even has been found associated with this, our likelihood to develop our risk of diabetes, type 2 diabetes. It even affects our ovaries and our testes in terms of the hormone secretion and our blood vessel health. When we have broken circadian rhythms, the risk for many diseases, including obesity, diabetes, heart disease, fatty liver disease, gut diseases, and cancer goes up. But by nurturing our rhythms, we can prevent, manage, and even reverse many of these diseases. How can we nurture these rhythms? Can we reset the clock? Yes. What do you have to do? We can move from a healthy clock to a disrupted clock. Or we can move from a disrupted clock to a healthy clock by changing how we live. Can I start living in flow and in rhythm and with regularity? And this is when I eat, and this is when I eat. And I fast in between, and this beautiful picture of harmony that God was giving to us and that we see so beautifully written on our physiology. Intestinal microbiota, circadian rhythms regulated by time of eating. High-fat diet also impairs the clock of our gut, as well as we said, if our master gland clock isn't working well. And this is just another slide kind of reinforcing. Did I think this was important for you to know? Yeah. So this is just another slide showing, yes, it has a big deal with obesity and our glucose intolerance. Diabetes is accompanied by dysregulation of the circadian system. It's not just sugar, right? Whenever people say, type 2 diabetes, they think of one thing, no, or they think of weight, but it can actually be this dysregulation of our clocks. When we have broken circadian rhythms, the risk for many diseases includes. We've looked at that. All right. Then I read, the sun is the Lord's doctor. There is healing in its beams, one of nature's most healing agents. Do you view the sun that way? Or is it your arch enemy, right? Which you're slathering yourself up with everything to kind of prevent it. I wear hats all the time on the sun, so I get it. But the sun is one of God's doctors. We know about vitamin D, right? It's the can-do-it-all, you know, hormone vitamin. It's so powerful. Just from having the sun shine upon us, we produce this sunshine vitamin that is such an important immune regulator. Deficiency of vitamin D, so profound in impacting our autoimmune disease risk. It sets the circadian clock. It affects our hormonal rhythms. It reduces MS and autoimmunity. It inhibits the development of cancer, reduces inflammation and oxidative stress. It affects glucose regulation and reduces insulin resistance. And it's a vitamin D. The vitamin D receptor is on most cells. It's also super important for maintaining a healthy gut lining. Leaky gut is really much affected when we have vitamin D deficiency. But that's not the only benefit that we get from the sunshine. So we need to expose our body, our skin. They say 40% of your skin needs to be exposed to the sun at least 20 minutes a day. How many of us do that? Right? So we learn to pop vitamin D supplements. But a vitamin D supplement cannot replace this. So we have melatonin, as we mentioned, that's produced in the master gland that lets us know, it's dark time, right? And that does all those amazing, accomplishes all those amazing roles in our brain while we're sleeping. But then there's peripheral melatonin. And this peripheral melatonin is produced by infrared rays of light, even penetrating through clothing. When you go out in the sunshine and you feel that warmth on your skin and you feel that kind of, that's these rays that are penetrating through our skin, and as they're going in past our skin layer, they're causing our little energy producers in our cells to produce melatonin. And this is taking place in the rest of my body. Well, why would I need melatonin during the daytime in my peripheral body cells? This melatonin is the most powerful antioxidant that our body produces in neutralizing free radical damage that can occur in those little energy factories themselves. So sunlight is like neutralizing and protecting these mitochondria from all the oxidative stress that can take place that can really lay the foundation for so much disease and pain and inflammation that we're experiencing today. 95% of melatonin is made inside the mitochondria in response to near-infrared radiation from the sun. It protects the mitochondria by neutralizing excessive free radicals. We're going to skip that one. Then I read that nature is God's physician. Ah, do you believe that? I never actually read this guy's book, but he developed the whole nature deficit disorder concept where it describes the human costs of alienation from nature. Among them, diminished use of the senses, attention difficulties, and higher rates of physical and emotional illnesses. The disorder can be detected in individuals, families, and communities. We need nature. God put us in a garden. Then I read again and again, I've been shown that God's trying to lead us back step by step to his original design, that man should subsist upon the natural products of the earth. He's leading us back. Did you know that 99.4% of participants in these studies that have been done with heart disease were able to avoid major cardiac events by switching to a plant-based diet? And these are just, again, I'm just going to show you, because we could talk, this topic could, you know, take our whole weekend. It's so amazingly interesting. There's so much information about it. But I'm just going to show you these one-liners from PubMed articles. Ameliorating chronic kidney disease using a whole food plant-based diet. Effectiveness of plant-based diets in promoting well-being in the management of type 2 diabetes. Plant-based foods and their bioactive compounds for fatty liver disease. The effects of vegetarian and vegan diets in improving our gut health, and so on. It's amazing. If I know that God is leading us back, and if you're not aware of the science behind it, I would encourage you to look, because there's a lot of it. Then I read, between the mind and the body, there's a mysterious and wonderful relation. They react upon each other. To neglect the body is to neglect the mind. Now, at one time, this was considered absolute rubbish, and yet we now know that the mind and the body are truly intimately connected. We knew it from before, from these writings, but then we learned it just from science. So we've heard the gut referred to as our second brain. Why? Because there's like, I don't know, 100 trillion nerve cells that are all stationed there at the gut. They call it our enteric nervous system. So some of the same kind of cells, right, that we would find here are down here. That we produce 90% of our serotonin in our gut, 60% of the dopamine in our gut. What's it doing there? So much, right? So many roles, but this enteric nervous system is communicating directly with our brain. And I love this picture of the microbes in our gut, just, you know, and the brain's just kind of listening to their conversation. What are they saying? And getting information, getting cues from it, and getting directions as to how to function even. So here, this slide just shows three pathways in which the gut, the community of gut microbes, can affect our mental health, including depression, through the immune system, all right, through the endocrine system, that's our hormones, and through the central nervous system. These are the pathways that we found are connecting. So we have this large vagus nerve that literally, you know, connects the body, gets information from the body and takes it to the brain and takes information to the brain down to the body. But we've learned that 90% of that information is actually traveling up. So it's a two-way highway, but 90% of the traffic is actually going up to the brain, communicating with the brain rather than the brain directing, you know, what's going on in the body. And then that other slide is just to show you that these bacteria in our gut are actually producing molecules, and these molecules affect our immune function, and the immune function affects inflammation, and that inflammation can be affecting your knee or your mood. So you'll hear these kinds of terms now very often in medicine, and that's the gut-brain axis, the gut-brain-liver axis, the HP, the hypothalamic-pituitary-adrenal gland axis, the immune-nerve-hormonal axis. What does that mean? It's just saying all these three, they work together These are systems that they found direct, intimate communication. It's not a one-man job. It's not just the brain. They're in cahoots with each other, bringing about a beautiful, harmonious, physiologic function. And then I read this. A close sympathy exists between the physical and the moral nature. Whatever injures the health not only lessens physical vigor, but tends to weaken the mental and moral powers. Since the mind and the soul find expression through the body, both mental and spiritual vigor are in a great degree dependent upon physical strength and activity. Then I learned about this word, hull. At least that's how I pronounce it, hull. It's an Anglo-Saxon ancient word used like in the 11th century. And from that hull word, we now came the words of healthy and whole and holy. And at one time, the word hull was used to express all three of these concepts. Anglo-Saxon root words are pretty cool. They cannot be broken down into smaller words or word parts. Knowing the meaning of one root word helps the student learn the meaning of other related words. And that's what I would like to share with you in relation to hull. So hull, there was an expression, Wes Hull, and that meant may you be in good health, which migrated to the greeting hail, right? Are you familiar with more familiar with hail? That was a Scottish word that meant health, happiness, wholeness. That's what I'm wishing for you. I'm wishing you to hailness, this concept of wholeness in all aspects of your being. So I love this idea that at one time, if I wanted to say, communicate something about health or wholeness or holiness, I would be using this one root word, hull. So Jesus understood this concept because he designed it. And so when he went to heal people, he went with the intention of making them whole. He said this to the lame man, will you be made whole? And the lame man rose and walked. Well, this was done on the Sabbath day, and it really angered the leaders of the Jews, the Jewish leaders, that he did this. And Jesus, in reference to this experience, said, are you angry with me? Because I made a man every whit whole on the Sabbath day. Do you know what every whit means? Whole, entire, complete. Jesus was saying, are you angry that I made someone wholly whole? Every whit whole? Completely whole? Hull, whole? Right? I didn't just make him walk. I didn't just heal this person of their leprosy. My desire is wholeness for you in all the components of who you are. We tend to kind of separate these concepts, right? Health, we've kind of tried to understand it better. So we've separated these concepts to give them clear definitions, we think. But in the meantime, we've lost something. And what we've lost is that they really belong together, right? That was God's original design for us, was to experience healthy, happy, holy, wholeness at a level that we could only imagine. And I want it so bad. Hull is just this beautiful picture and experience that God has for us. And it is the same word as perfect, right? This wholeness that God wants to restore us to. So really, all those arrows should be pointing in the exact same direction. When we read that the health message was given for our salvation, it's not saying that it's another thing on the checklist, thing that we have to do in order to be saved. It's saying that what supports and strengthens one aspect of who I am is supporting and strengthening all aspects of who I am. Can you imagine that getting this body and this physiological sinking with my mind and with my soul, that is experiencing wholeness. We are incomplete, broken, and fractured, and God wants to put us together again. And when you look at how the human was designed, we are walking and talking receptors. We are these biological transducers that convert energy from external and internal stimuli, and we change that into electrical impulses. We translate sunlight into vitamins and into hormones and the antioxidants like melatonin. We transform food into molecular signals that program our body and that set the tempo in our gut and that change everything. We are hugged and it's turned into oxytocin, right? We smell, and that becomes a memory that we can think about the next time we have that same smell. We behold God's word, and by beholding, we become changed. And it's just amazing that this information that God wants to give to us that will radically change how we live, but also our experience. The Holy Spirit's also, it's interesting how in the Spirit of Prophecy says the Holy Spirit comes like an electric shock and thrills every nerve into new life. And this is all just coming in to our body through our senses, and this is what our lifestyle, why our lifestyle is so integral to our spirituality. Hal enlarges the definition of health to be more than freedom from disease. And this is what God intended. It was his design. Wholeness must incorporate every facet of who we are. To understand why our health message is, what its role is, and its relationship to our spirituality, to our salvation, as well as to our physical health and our mental health, is something that I believe the world desperately needs. And this is what we have been equipped with. It's our responsibility to the world. The promise is, as many as touched him were made whole. Why would God tag a health message onto the gospel? Because it's the whole thing.